I'm Marty Moscoe-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. The aftermath of the 2020 election continues to reverberate here in Pennsylvania. On Friday, Commonwealth Court struck down Act 77 that allowed no excuse mail-in voting. It was passed with bipartisan support in the legislature and signed by Democratic Governor Wolf in 2019. The decision was immediately appealed to the state Supreme Court, which means the law stays in effect, at least for now. The Congressional House panel investigating the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol subpoenaed two Pennsylvania electors who cast provisional ballots for former President Trump, even though Biden won the state by more than 80,000 votes. Allegations of fraud have been tossed out by a number of courts in spite of Trump's ongoing lies about voter fraud in the Commonwealth. Meanwhile, the race for the U.S. Senate is heating up in this battleground state with control of the Senate in D.C. in the balance. There's a race for governor with Tom Wolf in his last year in office. Oh, and one more thing. There are 13 congressional redistricting maps under consideration. Well, today in Radio Times, we catch you up on all things PA politics, and we have three guests. Joining us by Skype is Katie Meyer. She is WHYY political reporter. And Katie, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Great to be here.
Nice to have you with us. Also with us, Jonathan Tamari. He's the national political reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Jonathan, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
You're very welcome. And also with us, Stephen Medvick. He's director of the Center for Politics and Public Affairs at Franklin and Marshall College, which is in Pennsylvania, author of a book called Gerrymandering, The Politics of Redistricting in the United States. And Stephen Medvick, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. And to our listeners, we want to make sure that you can join our conversation at any time. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Well, let's start with what the Commonwealth Court decided on Friday. And Katie, if I can start with you, what is the reasoning behind this court's decision?
You're talking about to overturn Act 77,
yes.
Marty?
Yes, I am.
Yes. So this has been kind of a point of contention for a while. Act 77 passed in 2019, and it was bipartisan at the time. And in fact, it was almost unanimously supported by Republicans. Actually, Democrats were the ones who voted against it in some numbers because they were upset about a provision that got rid of straight ticket voting. But in the years since that happened, and I should say Act 77 dramatically expanded mail voting in Pennsylvania. Before, you needed an excuse. It was pretty limited. Now it was no excuse. Anybody could vote by mail. And it expanded deadlines. It made it easier. So fast forward a year and change, and Donald Trump loses Pennsylvania. And around the time that it wasn't looking good for him, he began sowing these, you know, sort of this rhetoric about mail voting not being good for him, being riddled with fraud. This is baseless stuff.
Right.
And it did, though, get a lot of Republicans on this bandwagon of questioning the validity of mail-in votes, of, you know, the way, the security of that system. And since, it's become a real political issue. And so now you had this lawsuit saying that the law itself was passed improperly because it was passed as a simple bill and not as a constitutional amendment, which some people thought it should be. And so the Commonwealth Court thought that that was a good argument, and they overturned the law. Now, it's being appealed immediately. There's not going to be any changes during the appeal, and the Supreme Court may very well rule differently.
Well, let me get you in on the conversation, Jonathan Tamari. So does this open the door, do you think, in the legislature for bringing back voter ID or getting rid of drop boxes? Or are we just sort of at this moment of kind of stasis until the Supreme Court decides?
Well, the Supreme Court is going to weigh in on whether this mail voting law remains in place, but there is still a major opening for some of those changes you mentioned and others. And I've written about this recently. It's all really going to come down in many ways to the governor's race this year, because we have seen states across the country add new restrictions on voting since the 2020 election. And one of the reasons that hasn't happened in Pennsylvania is that you've got a Republican legislature and a Democratic governor who would block any of those laws. But, you know, Governor Wolf is term limited. There's an election to replace him. The Republicans running for governor have all said that if they win, they will repeal Act 77. You know, regardless of what the court does, they can pass a law to repeal it, that they will require voter ID, that they'll restrict drop boxes. Some of them have said they would eliminate mail voting almost entirely unless you are physically out of the state on election day. And so, yeah, all of those things are on the table, and a lot of them will be determined by who wins the governor's office, because the Democrat, the main Democrat running, Josh Shapiro, has said he would block all those ideas. So it's one of the most clear policy contrasts in this election, and really one of the biggest stakes in this election when you consider that, you know, over 2.6 million Pennsylvanians used mail voting in the 2020 election.
Well, let me get you in on the conversation, Stephen Medvec, and just picking up on both what Jonathan and Katie said. I mean, if that comes to pass, it really is turning the clock back on some of these new voting laws that we've had in the last couple of years. It is also popular, and I wonder whether that's a consideration at all.
Act 77 is popular.
Well, certainly mail-in voting. If you got 2.6 million people using it, people liked it.
Right. But so were things like voter ID. So, you know, rolling back, it would be rolling back the election laws to at least a few years ago, to a time when it was fairly restrictive. Now, some people would argue it wasn't extraordinarily restrictive, but you know, there are a lot of states that have no excuse mail-in voting, and that's been the trend, that more and more states are going that direction, just making it more convenient and easier to vote. I mean, as Katie mentioned, one of the other things that Act 77 did was allowed you to register to vote, changed it from 30 days before the election to 15 days before the election, and that's a real stumbling block for a lot of people, especially when they move. So Act 77 in a number of ways made it just more convenient and easier to vote. And if some of these things were rolled back, you know, again, some people would argue it wouldn't be extraordinarily restrictive, but it would be harder than it currently is.
And I wonder, too, maybe even reading the state Supreme Court, and I don't know, let me go back to you, Stephen Medvec. I don't know how political this is, because apparently Commonwealth Court is 3 Republicans, 2 Democrats. You get to the state Supreme Court, and there are more Democrats than Republicans. Is this all political when all is said and done?
Well, I wouldn't say it's all political. A lot of it is, though, right? I mean, we do have judges who are elected in this state, and they have partisan identification and partisan affiliations, and it's really hard to separate those things out nowadays. I mean, given the trends in polarization, how polarized politics have become, it's really, really hard to say, you know, to think that a judge could be completely objective. You know, in this case, I mean, I think it looks pretty clear that the legislature has the ability, has the power to make the kind of changes they made in Act 77. So I think the Supreme Court will probably reverse what the Commonwealth Court decided. And I think they'll be on pretty good constitutional grounds, pretty good legal grounds. And in fact, the legal judgment in the legislature at the time Act 77 was passed was that it was in fact constitutional. And that's in part because they kind of separated no excuse mail-in ballots from absentee balloting. Right. And they kind of, you know, the language kind of matters. So, again, the Constitution provides for the legislature to be able to determine the means by which electors cast ballots. And so I think if the court were to overturn it, you know, it would help Democrats. It would be the Democrats' preferred option. But it also probably has really good standing, legally speaking.
Here's an email from Dean, and Katie, I'll just toss it to you. Dean says, instead of using post office-based mail-in voting, why can't we vote electronically using our smartphones? Almost everyone has a smartphone. There are secure methods available to validate the ID of the voter. And now I realize we're talking PA politics here, but is it even under consideration, do you think?
In Pennsylvania, it's not under consideration. I think, you know, one thing at a time here. We're right now under a lot of controversy over whether mail voting is okay. But yeah, I mean, listen, different states do voting very differently. This is not unprecedented, this idea of an electronic option. And it's probably something you're going to see increasingly in the coming years. But I would say, you know, legislatures move slowly, especially a legislature like Pennsylvania's.
Well, let me go back to you, Jonathan, and I wonder whether the legislature, assuming it stays Republican, would revisit Act 77. I remember on election night election days of 2020, Trump was ahead because that was people voting in person. And then when it came to adding up and counting all the mail-in ballot, that's when Biden pulled ahead and got his 80,000 additional votes. Do you think just that whole couple of days of process will get Republicans to rethink Act 77?
Yeah, I think so. And I think that it honestly would have happened regardless of that process. You know, Trump, for months leading up to the election, had attacked mail voting as corrupt, despite all evidence being from numerous states that it's secure and has been used in five states, in fact, almost entirely for some time, without any suggestion of significant fraud in those places. I think that, yes, Act 77 became a political lightning rod leading up to the election, even more so after he made his claims after the election, which have been debunked but have still taken hold with many people. And so I do think that the state legislature is going to make changes. They believe that the Secretary of State, the Wolf administration, overstepped some of the bounds of Act 77 with some of the decisions in the state Supreme Court that, for example, allowed mail ballots that arrived after Election Day but were postmarked by Election Day to be considered. Ultimately, those, I believe, were not actually counted in the end, but that was a decision that was made leading up to the election. And so they all have signaled that they, Republicans almost universally have signaled that they want to scale that back. And I think even if they don't have the governor's office, that they're going to want to take that step to at least symbolically show where they are and force a Democratic governor to veto it. And of course, they hope that they'll have a Republican governor to sign it.
Which is why this governor race coming up. Stephen, we're almost up on a break here, about a minute away from the break. Any evidence of wide-scale voter fraud in Pennsylvania in 2020?
No, there's absolutely none. And there's, you know, the key word there is widespread. I mean, there are always, in all elections, there is a voter here or there who does something that they shouldn't do, sometimes by accident. So even that isn't, I wouldn't really call, you know, fraudulent. But there is, not only in Pennsylvania, but nationwide, very, very little fraud. And no systematic widespread fraud, or when there is, like there was a case in North Carolina where there was some fraud involving absentee ballots, it's pretty easy to find. It's pretty easy to see because it's widespread. So there's really no reason to worry about the integrity of elections in Pennsylvania or in the United States.
And that's Stephen Medvick. He's director of the Center for Politics and Public Affairs at Franklin and Marshall College, which is in Pennsylvania. Jonathan Tamari is with us as well, Philadelphia Inquirer national political reporter, and Katie Meyer. She's WHYY's political reporter. And we are catching us all up on all things PA politics. There is a lot going on, a lot more to discuss as well. And again, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. Tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Give us a call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moskowang, talking with Katie Meyer, Jonathan Tamari, and Stephen Medvick about PA politics, getting caught up on some news. And, of course, this is an important year here in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. An open Senate seat. We've got a race for governor. So there's a lot going on. Katie, let me go back to you. Last couple of days, some Democratic officials, I shouldn't say some, I guess these are 300 or so Democratic officials met to endorse a Senate candidate. What happened?
Well, they didn't endorse anybody for Senate. They did do endorsements for governor and lieutenant governor. Those weren't super difficult endorsements. Josh Shapiro is the only person running, or the only Democrat, I should say, a high-profile Democrat running for governor, so he got that endorsement. Austin Davis, who is his like chosen running mate, got the lieutenant governor endorsement. But when it came to Senate, we have four major candidates in the field: Montgomery County Commissioner Valar Cush, Congressman Connor Lamb, Lieutenant Governor John Fetterman, and State Rep Malcolm Kenyatta. And there was no endorsement. Lamb came the closest to getting the number of votes needed for that. You need a two-thirds vote from the Democratic committee, which is like several hundred, you know, party insiders, basically. Right. And yeah, no endorsement.
Well, let me go back to you, Jonathan. Tamari, as I understand it, Lamb got 159, Fetterman 64, Kenyatta 42, and Val Arkush couldn't get past the first ballot. Do you think there's any significance in these numbers?
There is. Even though Lamb did not get the endorsement, and there's a lot of spin and argument about what that means, you know, I tend to think in politics, if you get the most votes, that's generally a good thing. But again, this is a limited audience, right? These are state party members. These are people who are very involved in Democratic politics. There's a clear signal there that Connor Lamb is the preferred choice of kind of the party establishment, the Democratic establishment in Pennsylvania. And there's been a number of signals of this, and this has been kind of, that's the most hard, concrete number that's really been put on it. What's interesting is that John Fetterman, by a lot of the traditional counts, looks like the person who's got the strongest foundation. He's got by far the most fundraising. All the polls that we've seen, even though there aren't many, show him to have a significant lead in polling. And he's an established figure being the lieutenant governor, but you're not seeing the party really rally around him. So you've got this contrast that is pretty unusual. And, you know, I think you see two very different paths for the two of them. And we're going to see over these coming months which one actually works out.
Well, let me read a tweet from one of our listeners that speaks, Jonathan, to what you just said. I'm not sure who this is, but they said the best thing a state Democratic organization can do is stay out of the Senate primary. Let the Democratic voters decide. 4 years ago, the party pushed the nomination of a proven weak candidate who lost to a mediocre to me, according to our listener. Let me go to you, Stephen Medvick. And it is interesting, especially those of us who live here in the eastern part of Pennsylvania. It looks like the two contenders are from the western part of the state, Connor Lamb and John Fetterman. What do you make of this matchup of these? I don't want to cut out, you know, Kenyatta or Arkush, but nonetheless, as it stands now, it looks like these two are the combatants when it comes to the primary.
Yeah, and I think that's because Democrats, and particularly Democratic, you know, insiders and activists, are thinking about who can appeal statewide. And, you know, it's pretty clear that they're going to have to appeal in cities, but also in rural areas. And so I think that's essentially what this comes down to. Now, whether rank-and-file Democratic voters take the signal or not is another question. I tend to think that they will. I mean, there are differences, you know, within the Democratic Party. There are factions in the Democratic Party, but they're not as intense as the factional fighting in the Republican Party was, say, 5 years ago. I think some of that factional fighting has subsided to some extent, but in the Democratic Party, I think, you know, the establishment still kind of carries some weight. So what happened, I think, over the weekend was really important for Lamb, because it'll send a signal to those rank and file Democrats that, okay, here's some people following this very, very closely, and they're being strategic, and this is who they think might be the strongest candidate for the fall.
And Katie, just picking up on that, Mayor Kinney of Philadelphia endorsed Connor Lamb. Does that mean anything? Does he have coattails, do you think, in this city?
Oh, I mean, you know, depends on who you ask, I guess.
Sure.
But I think it is a signal, right, that, you know, and Kenny he's endorsed more progressive candidates in the past. It really depends. Lamb has also got a lot of support from labor across the state. And Fetterman, as a labor guy, you would kind of think that he might be doing better with those endorsements. So I think it's all, you know, a sign that there is some attempt to coalesce around Lamb as maybe the safe candidate, or the candidate who they think is going to do the best in the general election against a Republican. But I will say, again, like, we talk a lot about party insiders and what we're thinking.
Sure.
And what they're thinking, but the State Democratic Committee, you know, doesn't have the best track record of choosing which candidate is actually going to win a race or even win a primary. You know, it's not like this, you know, endorsement or even winning the vote is determinative historically of success. So, you know, it's a point for Lamb in that, you know, they didn't endorse, but he got the closest. But it's not definitive.
Well, picking up on that, Stephen, let me go back to you. I mean, it just seems, broadly speaking, that parties just don't have the kind of clout that they used to have, that they're more independents, even if they end up with one, you know, in one camp or another. But, you know, in many ways, like, who cares what the party elders say, right?
That's a really good point. And I mean, the best example of that, of course, was Donald Trump himself, right, who none of the party insiders wanted back in 2015, 2016. And yet he was able to get the nomination. So it's a good point. And we're political scientists are kind of rethinking our theories about how nominations work. And yet I will say, you know, look at Joe Biden. Right. I mean, here was the not even really the clear establishment favorite, but because of inside support, especially in South Carolina, you know, he was able to get the nomination. And you know, that was much to progressive consternation. But nevertheless, you know, he was able to win the nomination. So I think in the Democratic Party, again, the establishment still has, you know, still has some clout. Even if Katie's right that the track record of the state Democratic Party is not great, but when party insiders rally behind somebody in the Democratic Party, it carries more weight than maybe it did in the Republican Party.
Well, that's interesting. Well, let's talk about the Republicans. And Jonathan, I'll go back to you. We're talking about, you know, current Senator Toomey's seat. We can call it that. He's been there a while. He is a Republican. There was I don't know how seriously to take a GOP straw poll from the center of Pennsylvania, but nonetheless, real estate developer Jeff Bartos came out on top. What are we to make of the Republican candidates for the U.S. Senate?
So the Republican field, I think, is there are some clear separations in different approaches in those candidates, and there have been a number of these straw polls. Jeff Bartos has done very well in some of them, which reflects some grassroots support. But the challenge for him is that you've got two ultra wealthy candidates just spending a ton of money on television right now, who seem to have, or at least from the outside, seem to have the upper hand. And we don't have a lot of polling to put specific numbers on this, but you've got Mehmet Oz, you know, the celebrity known as Dr. Oz, has bought more than $7 million of airtime already on television.
Really? Just $7 million?
More than that, yeah, which is just an extraordinary amount this early in the race. Like, people who I know who've done politics for a long time say they've never seen this kind of spending this far out ahead of an election. David McCormick, who's a former hedge fund CEO, used to lead the world's largest hedge fund until a little earlier this month, is also spending a lot of money. He's up over $4 million on TV. And so I'm sure people in the Philly area have probably seen these folks coming into their living rooms. And so you've got these candidates who are not as well established in the political world in Pennsylvania, but who are just bombarding the airwaves right now. The straw polls gave us kind of the first quick look at things, but what is widely expected is that there will not be a statewide endorsement in the Republican Party, which is unusual for them. Unlike the Democrats, the Republican State Committee has a very good track record of picking the winner in their primaries, but the field is so divided right now that when they meet this weekend, there is the expectation is that they won't endorse anybody, and it's going to be this expensive, drawn-out primary. I haven't even mentioned all the candidates who are up spending money. I haven't mentioned all their super PACs that are up spending money. It's going to be an extraordinary primary on the Republican side and hugely costly.
Well, let me just toss out a couple of names. And Jonathan, there are probably more than this. Kathy Barnett, we mentioned Oz, David McCormick. You mentioned Carla Sands, George Bichetto, Martin Rosenfeld. Any other names, Jonathan, we should at least have on our consciousness?
So those are the main names to be aware of, and so it's very crowded right now. Oz and McCormick seem to be getting the most attention. When you talk to people in the party, they kind of come down on either one of those two having the strongest opportunity. Bartos is trying to run that kind of, you know, grassroots campaign to overcome all that money, and which is ironic because he is himself very personally wealthy. He just isn't quite as wealthy as these other folks. And Carla Sands is trying to appeal to President Trump, but she has not gotten a lot of traction so far. And so, this race is still taking shape.
Katie, is it all about money and spending on ads?
Well, it's not all about that, but right now it's a lot about that. I mean, again, as Jonathan was saying, you had two just very, very wealthy people come in and just strafe Pennsylvania with these TV ads. And McCormick very recently lived in Connecticut, Oz very recently lived in New Jersey, and they are kind of banking on that not mattering. And I would say, the money has made an enormous difference in this race. This is going to be, again, as Jonathan said, a hugely expensive race. There's really not that much to compare it to. This doesn't happen that much where you get these like super independently wealthy candidates just self-funding their way to success. But you have seen that in the past in other races. And one of the ones that always comes to mind for me is when Tom Wolf first ran for governor, he put $10 million of his own money into his campaign and put it into TV ads and saw great success in the primary kind of out of nowhere. He was not well known in Pennsylvania. So that's actually orders of magnitude smaller than what we're probably going to end up seeing in this race. But, it's another point of like it can be done and it works.
And that's Katie Meyer, again, WHYY political reporter. Jonathan Tamari with us as well. He's the Philadelphia Inquirer national political reporter. And Stephen Medvick, rounding out our trio of guests, director of the Center for Politics and Public Affairs at Franklin and Marshall College. Well, Stephen, picking up on what both Jonathan and Katie said about all this money that's already being spent here in Pennsylvania. I mean, is it all about money? Is it all about ads? Is that in the final analysis when, all the confetti is being swept away, that's what it is?
I think Katie's right. It's not all about money. The money helps. And it generally is the case that the candidate that spends the most money wins the election. But that's, that's assuming that money's spent well, that it's spent strategically and wisely. But money alone won't do it. There's going to have to be some organizing on the ground. They're going to have some grassroots support. They're going to have volunteers and ultimately, voters who go to the polls for them. So, I think what a candidate like Bartos might have a smart strategy here because he's trying to build that grassroots support and letting McCormick and Oz maybe take each other out. So that's a lot of spending. But right now it's pretty negative and it's directed, at one another. And what they may find is both of them end up, being harmed by all that spending. I think a candidate has to make a positive case at the end of the day. And right now, that's not what you're hearing in this race.
And Stephen, do debates matter? And Jonathan, I'll get to you in a second. Do debates matter? Do voters watch them and does that help them make up their mind one way or the other?
It's hard to say. I mean, most of the people who pay attention are paying attention to the to a debate or paying attention to the race just generally. And if they tune in, they probably already have a preferred candidate. But what can happen is if somebody really emerges from a debate having done well or having done poorly, that word will get out through media coverage and through word of mouth, people talking about what just happened the night before. So the aftermath of the debate can have some impact. But mostly what we see in studies of debate effects is that they have a short-term effect, but then they kind of dissipate over time. So it might help a candidate, leap forward for a little while, but probably won't have lasting impact.
Jonathan, it sounded like you wanted to add something.
I just did. I just wanted to amplify something that Stephen was saying about money. I mean, remember, Michael Bloomberg came into the Democratic presidential race in 2020 and spent a whole ton of money and didn't go almost anywhere. And it was because his message was out of step with what Democratic voters wanted. So you still need to have the right message. But in a state that's as big as Pennsylvania, it's not like you can win Pennsylvania by knocking on doors. It's just too big and too many people. So you do need to be able to deliver that message. And that's where I think the money comes in and can overwhelm. And as Katie mentioned, Governor Wolf, one big difference here is that Wolf kind of had the airwaves to himself because nobody else could match him at that time. That's not the case with Oz because McCormick is up there challenging him too. So nobody has a free run here, even though they each have a ton of personal wealth that they're putting into the race.
Jonathan?
Go ahead, Steve.
Could I just add quickly? Sure, sure.
You know, the money really does matter, though, where candidates are not that well known. So it's a good point that Jonathan makes about Bloomberg. But in a presidential race, most of the candidates are pretty well known. I would argue that McCormick and even Oz, and certainly Bartos and maybe Carlos Sands, you know, they're not all that well known. Oz is a celebrity, but nobody knows a lot about his positions on issues, you know, where he stands politically. So the money could really matter for an unknown candidate or a candidate who's undefined. But again, they have to spend that money wisely, I think.
Well, Katie, we should talk about issues, right? I mean, this is what elections are about. When we look at Pennsylvania, obviously the economy, COVID, I'm assuming infrastructure with that bridge that fell down, that sort of focuses the mind. Mandates. I mean, what else do you think voters in Pennsylvania care about and want their elected representatives, especially someone in the U.S. Senate, to go there to fight for?
It's a big question. I think it really depends on what party they are in. And I think, you know, what you hear kind of coming through as the top issues in a primary, they tend to be very broad brush. So, for example, in the Republican primary for U.S. Senate, we see some general rhetoric about securing the border. We see stuff about, you know, freedom from mandates, things like that. And these are like the big, you know, hot button political issues that we see these candidates clinging to. I did a story a couple of weeks ago about, you know, candidates across the Senate race and the governor race on the Republican side amplifying this thing about quote-unquote ghost flights, which Lou Barletta had started. And basically what it was a very standard, you know, federal procedure for immigrant children. They can't be in federal custody for more than 72 hours. So often they're brought to different states to be cared for. And that was what was happening. But, you know, it just got amplified on conservative media. And there was all this rhetoric about, oh, no, like immigrants are coming into Pennsylvania and we won't have that once I am in office. So something like that, I think, is, you know, that's not necessarily what a voter wants.
Right.
But that is often what voters in the GOP primary are getting right now.
And that is Katie Meyer, WHYY political reporter, joining us along with Jonathan Tamari, the Philadelphia Inquirer's national political reporter, and Stephen Medvick, director of the Center for Politics and Public Affairs at Franklin and Marshall College. We are talking about PA politics. We've got a lot of comments here. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. You can call us 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We're getting an update on a bunch of PA politics issues that are at play with Katie Meyer, WHYY political reporter, Jonathan Tamari, national political reporter with the Philadelphia Inquirer, and Stephen Medvick, director of the Center for Politics and Public Affairs at Franklin and Marshall College. Let me read a couple of comments here, and then I want to get back to the three of you. Claire says, I'll be voting for Lieutenant Governor John Fetterman for Senate. However, I think for him to win, he needs to expand his image beyond legalizing marijuana. His social media and email messaging thus far has been sophomoric. A comment from Jim, the only thing that's going to straighten out our government is voter-induced term limits. Vote them out. They've corrupted our politics. An email from Jack who says it's very worth pointing out that the two Democratic candidates for U.S. Senate who got the most support from the Dems in the State House, Lamb and Fetterman, are both white men who are often seen as safe, electable candidates, while Kenyatta and Arkush are not white men and typically seen as less electable. Let me just kind of leave that out there. And I want to pick up on one thing in terms of issues that people might or things that people might care about, Jonathan Tamari, in this primary year and then, of course, the general election. How much do you think Trump will be a factor?
I think Trump will be a bit of a factor, will be maybe more than a bit, that's understating it, will be a factor in the Republican primary. I think that all of the candidates are in some way or another, to different degrees, signaling their support of either Trump himself or the policies that he put forward, or just echoing the kind of rhetoric that he put out about things like America first and protecting American jobs and things like that. That is certainly a part of the Republican Party now that I don't think is going away. And, of course, echoing his lies or kind of nodding to, even if they're not repeating them, they're kind of hinting at or winking at a lot of what he says that's untrue about the 2020 election. I'm not sure how much that translates into the general election, to be honest, because we have a new president. And generally, it's a referendum on the sitting president. And Joe Biden, you know, has a number of political liabilities right now. Inflation is a big concern. His poll numbers have dropped significantly. I think that a lot of this election might be about Joe Biden more than Trump, with the big wild card being Trump himself, as always, because he has a way of dominating attention, of wanting to dominate attention. And it's unclear if he'll kind of sit back and allow this election to be more about Joe Biden in the general election, or if he will insert himself and kind of influence the way the issues that are discussed and the way that voters view that election. I think that's something that we're all going to be watching to see as we get closer to November.
Jonathan, I know you interviewed a number of the Republican candidates for the U.S. Senate. Did any of them say, yes, Joe Biden is president of the United States?
Jeff Bartow, well, they will say Joe Biden is the president. They might not say whether he won legitimately. Jeff Bartow has acknowledged that Biden won. I did ask all of the candidates if they would have voted to certify Pennsylvania's election results, as Senator Pat Toomey, a Republican, did, and he strongly defended Pennsylvania's results when there was an attempt to throw them out. None of the Republicans in the race would say either way if they would have certified Pennsylvania's results, and I think that's something that's worth keeping in mind, especially as Donald Trump in recent days has stated clearly that his intention was to overturn the election. Those are his exact words in statements he's put out recently.
Well, Stephen, let me go to you. And I mentioned this in my introduction. The House committee has subpoenaed 14 what they call bogus electors who cast essentially false electoral votes for Trump in seven states, including Pennsylvania. There are two people who are named Bill Backenberg and Lisa Patton. Those are two of the 14 names. How unusual is it to have these electors that sort of had this sort of side issue going?
Oh, extremely unusual. I mean, in the modern era, it's not happened before. So I think the question with these slates of alternate electors is, who was organizing this? Because it a very similar thing happened in these seven states, down to, you know, the language, you know, on the documents and the font that was used. So I think the question that the committee is really going to be asking is, who was behind this? Who was coordinating it? And we're beginning to see more and more evidence that there really was a coordinated effort in the White House. You know, the New York Times is reporting yesterday, this morning, that President Trump contacted state lawmakers in several states, including Pennsylvania, asking them to have local law enforcement seize voting machines. And so I think, you know, that's really the question, is not so much what these individual actors were doing in several states, but who was really kind of the ringleader, who was coordinating all these efforts to overturn the election.
Katie, anything you want to add to that from what you know about Pennsylvania's legislature and politics?
Well, just that, you know, there was some pretty clear embrace of these ideas at the time in Pennsylvania. I think it's worth kind of restating. We've talked about it in the past, but, you know, lawmakers in Pennsylvania's legislature, the most powerful lawmakers in Pennsylvania's legislature, signed letters asking the Pennsylvania congressional delegation to delay the certification of the election. And so this was an idea that was very, very prevalent in the days leading up to January 6th.
Well, and I wonder, too, if I can go back to you, Jonathan. I know that this is the Senate Intergovernmental Operations Committee. I'm looking at a Penn Capital Star reporting that, you know, they're still pursuing the results of the 2020 election. Anything we should know about what is happening in in Harrisburg, I guess, sort of similar to what happened in Arizona, for instance.
Yeah, and it hasn't gone quite as far as Arizona, but there is definitely an effort to conduct some kind of Republican-led review of the results, which, again, is kind of a nod to this idea that something was fishy or something was wrong in the election, even though there's absolutely no evidence that there was in any significant way that could affect the outcome of the election, that there have been numerous reviews by independent authorities, by media, by Trump's own Justice Department that found that the election was secure, but that there is still this nod to it or this wink to it, even if people don't state it outright. And I think it's important to note that this isn't just about looking backwards at what happened in 2020. It's also looking forward at what could happen in 2024. Donald Trump has made it clear that he's at least considering running again. And Pat Toomey is leaving the Senate, as we've already discussed. So whoever replaces him could again be required to vote on whether or not to certify Pennsylvania's results, depending on the outcome. So this is a live question for everybody running for Senate and Congress right now.
And Stephen, what I noticed that what the GOP does is they say, look, we have to restore faith in our electoral process. But that's a faith that they have undermined by, by essentially calling fraud where fraud does not exist.
Right. I mean, you're exactly right. I think there is some concern about the integrity of elections. And look, election integrity is an important thing.
Sure.
But when you raise questions based on very little evidence and cause people to lose faith in elections and then say the lack of faith means we have to clamp down and make it harder to vote, it's a little cynical.
And that's Stephen Medvick, who joins us along with Jonathan Tamari, Katie Meyer. We are talking about PA politics. We do want to talk about congressional and legislative maps. But first, I want to make sure that you can join our conversation. Any questions or comments, email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Katie, you and I are radio people, so it's really hard to talk about maps on the radio. But I will just say what there are something like 13 congressional maps that are under some form of consideration.
Yeah, I think last time I checked, it was 14 that
14.
Were in the
okay.
court. Yeah, well, and then they're not all going to be kind of considered on the same merits. But so what is happening right now for anybody who needs a primer is the legislature is supposed to draw a congressional map and then the governor is supposed to sign it. That process has broken down, as we kind of always assumed it was going to, because the legislature is controlled by Republicans and the governor is a Democrat, Tom Wolf. And they have different priorities when it comes to these maps. And so that process no longer happening. The courts have taken it up. Right now, the matter is in the Commonwealth Court. And they said, as like kind of their method for this, they were going to have the parties to the case. There's 14, but not all arguing cases on the same kind of level. They all asked them to submit maps. They said they would pick one. But right now, as we speak, the Supreme Court has said it's going to review an appeal for the act court, the highest court in Pennsylvania, to take this matter up, which we always kind of expected was going to happen. So consideration of the 14 maps is paused right now while the court deliberates. And what we're expecting is that the Supreme Court will use like special jurisdiction to take up the case and select or draw a map on its own. So waiting to see what exactly they do. In the past, they've appointed a special master to draw a map. They've also picked one from, a slew of options in the early 90s, the last time that this kind of happened in a regular process. So TBD. But,
TBD, right.
Yeah.
Well, let me get you, Jonathan, because I'm actually looking at yesterday's Philadelphia Inquirer. It says the 13 redistricting choices with lots of maps and color-coordinated things, which obviously is hard to talk about on the radio. But what should our listeners know about this process, this redistricting process?
Yeah, it can be a very arcane process, but it's hugely influential because it draws the congressional maps for the next decade. And, the way you draw a district and how much which kind of territory is in, it can really determine whether it's within reach of both parties or only one party. You know, if you take a seat that's in suburban Philadelphia and add a little bit of Philadelphia to it, you get a much more Democratic-leaning district. If you instead extend it out the other way into more rural areas, you get many more conservative voters, and then it starts to lean rightward a little bit. So this can have a really huge influence on individual elections and then the overall control of the U.S. House, because that the House is divided. I think Republicans only need to gain, I believe, 5 seats in order to take control of that. And so if a map in Pennsylvania turns a Democratic seat a little bit more competitive, or a competitive seat more Republican, you know, that is gets you part of the way towards flipping control of the House. And again, it could set the stage for control over the next decade. So it's a really, really important thing that happens behind closed doors, but has a lot of long-lasting influence.
Well, Stephen, you wrote a book last year called Gerrymandering, The Politics of Redistricting in the United States. And based on what both Jonathan and Katie said, I mean, is it possible to come up with a fair congressional or a legislative map that's fair to everybody?
That's a great question. You know, there's a way to draw fairer maps. I would say there's probably not a way to draw a perfectly fair map,
right,
because there are just too many considerations. There are lots of really important things you have to keep in mind. You don't want to split you know, towns and counties. You want to do that as little as possible. Of course, in congressional maps, the population size have to be strictly equal, or as equal as possible, down to a person, maybe different in each congressional district. You can't discriminate based on race. So there's a number of things you have to kind of keep in mind. And I think that, you know, this is maybe an academic point, but I think anytime you have single member districts where you have to draw a district for a single representative, it's going to be really hard to get fair representation, because, you know, even a 50-50 split in a district means that half the district is going to be unrepresented by whoever wins.
Right.
So it's a very difficult process.
And is it mathematicians who in the end decide, Stephen?
Ultimately, it's politicians or judges who decide, but mathematicians have lots of ways to do this. And again, some of them are more fair than others. So there are a couple of metrics. And I think the Inquirer's breakdown of this its analysis of the competing maps was really, really good. But one of the things you see is that, you know, none of the maps actually are as good as the current map. That current map has 9 Democrats, 9 Republicans. Of course, we're losing a seat through reapportionment this year. But the current map's a pretty good map. And if you keep that as the standard, none of the maps out there match that standard.
I have a couple of questions here. We probably don't have time to get to them, but I'll just put them out there so our listeners know what people are thinking about. Judy says, regarding the fact that candidates can lose the popular vote but win through the Electoral College, is this why the Republicans are putting more restrictions on voting by mail and using other voting suppression tactics? A tweet from Stephen: today is the first day of Black History Month and the anniversary of the Greensboro, North Carolina sit-ins. Disenfranchising voters of color is a racist tactic that needs to be highlighted as such. Why is this happening today? And, you know, sadly, we don't have, you know, the kind of time to be able to give both of those questions the answers that they deserve, frankly. But let me just squeeze one more thing in. Katie, you wrote a story just a couple of years ago about infrastructure in Pennsylvania, and we know what happened on Friday. A bridge collapsed in western PA as President Biden was there to talk about infrastructure. In 20 seconds or less, what should we know about PA infrastructure? Sorry to do that to you, Katie.
Yeah, well, no, that's a good question. The topic came up again. We have this weird funding scheme in Pennsylvania where money from the Motor License Fund, which is supposed to go to road and bridge repairs, goes to the state police. It happened a long time ago. The legislature kind of set that up because they needed a way to pay for state police. And they were like, well, the state police use the highway system, so that makes sense. And since it's become kind of this boondoggle that Republicans and Democrats generally agree they should not have as a funding scheme anymore. But the challenge is, where do you get the money? Right. So we've got a lot of small towns and cities that don't have their own police forces. They would have to pony up some money maybe to kind of, replace that. Anyway, it's a whole mess.
It's a whole mess. Well, we're going to leave it there. Katie Meyer, thank you for joining us, and thank you for that very concise answer.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome. Jonathan Tamari, thank you as always for joining us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And Stephen Medvick, nice to have you back with us on the show.
Thanks so much. It's my pleasure.
You're very welcome. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder and Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moscow, and thank you so much for joining us.